Good morning and welcome to our first week of a brand new series on the Book of Romans. And I am so excited to jump into this. I've been thinking about this book, this letter now for a couple of weeks. I've really been immersing myself in it and thinking about it, reflecting on it, and thinking, what does this ancient letter have to speak to us today? And here's the answer. Plenty. So we're going to spend a couple of weeks in this letter, diving into it, looking at the ancient context of it, and then pulling it into the modern day. What does this ancient wisdom have to say for us in this modern world that we live in? So I hope you'll join us for this journey. As I said, we'll be here for the next couple of weeks together. And let me explain to you how this entire series came about. I guess over the past couple of years, there's been a few books that have caught my attention on the Book of Romans. And they started stacking up. First it was one, then it was another, and then a third book came on the scene. And I kept looking at these books thinking, wow, there's something here. I became more and more curious about the Book of Romans, especially as these books began to pile up a bit. And here's the assumption that I start with. Curiosity is the way in which the Spirit is getting your attention. So I begin this series with the assumption that my curiosity towards these books, towards the letter to the Roman Christians, the Book of Romans in our New Testament, my curiosity towards this, it's the Spirit saying, there's some wisdom here for you, for the congregation, for all of us in this world that we find ourselves in today. So let me show you these three books. If anyone wants to take a deeper dive into the Book of Romans, here's the three books that have inspired this sermon series. First, Reading Romans in Pompeii. I love this book. He takes a lot of the archaeological evidence that was discovered in Pompeii, and then he translates it to what life would have looked like in Rome. And then what some of the house churches in Rome would have looked like, the audience, the initial audience of Paul's letter to the Romans. Then we have Reading Romans Backwards by Scott McKnight. This one gets a bit academic, but helpful nonetheless. And he does exactly what the title says. He reads Romans backwards. His argument is Romans is a letter about power and privilege. And we don't actually see that truth until we look at the letter from the back to the front. Normally, this letter has become a very abstract theological letter. There's a whole bunch of really big theological terms and words that don't necessarily translate into our daily lives. So what he does in the book, he does this brilliantly, is he sets the scene. He says, hey, here's the audience that Paul would have been writing to. Here's the context in which this letter takes place. So instead of having this disembodied letter, this abstract letter, he actually grounds it in reality. And then he works through the entire letter that way. So that's a great book. And then here's one. This one might be my favorite. It's called Romans Disarmed. It's by Kiesmott and Walsh. If you want to be challenged in your reading of the book in Romans, read that one. If you want a nice, comfortable reading of Romans, don't read it. But if you're willing to jump in to have all sorts of expectations that you hold and beliefs that you hold questioned, and if you want to really dive deeply into the Roman Empire, which would have been at the height of its existence during the time of Paul's letter to the Romans, and how this letter subverts that empire and offers a completely radical and different way to live by following Jesus. That's the book for you. So those are three books that have inspired me, that set the groundwork for this entire series. And as I mentioned with those books, one of the things that I was really interested in when I started reading through Romans in order to teach on it, I remember going to seminary. The Book of Romans, it wasn't grounded in the historical context in which it was written. It ended up, what I was trained to do was kind of pull all these different pieces out of Romans, but not to read it as a whole, not to read it as a story, not to read it as a letter that was written to a specific group of people at a specific time in history for a very specific reason. That's what I wanted to do with this series. How can we look at this letter to the Romans in a way that grounds it in what was happening in the world, what was happening specifically in the lives of these Roman Christians at the time in which Paul wrote this letter? So that's the goal. That's my hope for all of us as we dive into this together, that we would see everything, well, I don't think we'll see everything, but that we would see a greater glimpse of what's going on and why Paul was inspired to write this letter, and then that we would pull it into the modern world for us today so that we can see that this letter, yeah, it was written 2,000 years ago, but it has so much meaning and truth for us in our lives right here, right now, with all that we're going through. So one more piece of groundwork. This will not be an exegetical study. We're not going to be going line by line through the book of Romans. So there will be things that we don't talk about. There'll be things that I miss, things that I didn't see in my reading through Romans this time around. All right, that's how it works, right? Where you read through a book, you study something, and there's different things that jump out at you, probably because of what you're going through in life, what you've experienced. You read that letter, you read the book, whatever it happens to be, 15 years later, 10 years later, I mean, even a year later, and there's all sorts of new things and ideas that you hadn't seen in your previous reading. So right now, I'm just going to pull out some of the main ideas and themes, the things that I've seen in my reading through Romans right now. Now, as we begin, what I want to do is I want to ground this letter in the historical context. So here are seven questions to ask about the book of Romans. When I was in fifth grade, our teacher, he said, whenever you're reading an article, whenever you're reading a book, there's five questions to ask. You need to ask who, what, where, when, why, and how. So these seven questions we're going to ask, these are my who, what, where, when, why, and now, so that we can all be on the same page, so we can all see it. See, if we miss this, if we skate by this a bit too quickly, we miss the entire context as to why Romans was written. And it becomes this disembodied text that isn't grounded in reality. First question, what is Romans? Very basic, is it not? What is Romans? It's a letter. It's a letter that was written to a specific audience for a very specific reason. Number two, who wrote Romans? Who wrote this letter? The Apostle Paul. He was a missionary going around the world at this time, spreading the good news of Jesus. Essentially, Paul was a pastor. He had a heart to lead people down the path of Jesus. So he's the one who's writing this letter to the Romans. Third question, who was it written to? Remember, these are really basic questions, I get it, but very important for understanding the full context of this letter. Who was it written to? It was written to Roman Christians living at the heart of the Roman Empire. Roman Christians, they weren't living on the outskirts of the Roman Empire. They were living right at the center, right in the city of Rome, where the Roman Empire, the power of Caesar, was seen in all of its splendor and glory. Probably would have been, scholars believe, maybe only about 100 to 200 Christians living in the city of Rome at this time. In a city of, I've seen estimates anywhere from 600,000 to a million people, only about 100, maybe as much as 200 of the people living in Rome would have considered themselves followers of Jesus. This is a very, very small percentage. This is a minority of the Roman population. And there would have been, instead of everyone, all the 100, 200 Christians gathering together, there would have been various communities throughout the city of Rome, various clusters of people who have gathered together in order to learn what it meant for them to follow Jesus, living in the heart of the Roman Empire. Question four, when was it written? This letter would have been written sometime in the late 50s AD. So we're 2,000 years about removed from this letter. This probably, Paul's letters, some of the earliest Christian writings that we have. These letters, including Romans, they actually predate our Gospels that we have in the New Testament. So this is a very, very early writing of the first followers of Jesus as they were working out together what it meant for them to follow Jesus and how to actually set their lives up in a way so they could follow Jesus, the way of Jesus, instead of the way of Caesar. Question 5, why was Romans written? Now, there's 3 reasons I put here as to why the letter of Romans would have been written. First, Paul's trying to promote unity. If we go to the end of the book, taking a page out of Scott McKnight's Reading Romans Backwards, we go to the end, Romans 16, verse 17. I urge you, brothers, to watch out for those who cause divisions and put obstacles in your way that are contrary to the teaching you have learned. Watch out for those who cause divisions. As we'll see over the next couple of weeks, there's a lot of tension in the church at Rome. There's a whole bunch of division. Part of the problem is you have Jewish Christians, and then you have Gentile or non-Jewish Christians trying to live in community together. There's a lot of tension between these two groups. There's a lot of animosity. These two groups, they don't really like each other a whole bunch. They have varying views as to what it means to follow Jesus. So it's causing a lot of division. What Paul wants, one of the things that Paul says right in his letter, I want to promote unity. I want you to learn to be a community together. Sure, there's lots of things that can divide you, but that's not what we're about. We're not about division. We're about unity. We're about creating a community of love. People who, yeah, they're diverse in lots of different things, including some of their beliefs. But at the end of the day, this community is united together in their pursuit of Jesus. And then a second reason why Paul writes this letter. Paul has a lot of, as he calls it, anguish. He has a lot of pain. There's sorrow. There's a certain passion that Paul has that motivates him, that compels him to write this letter. This is a letter that is birthed out of pain. Here's Paul in his own words, Romans chapter 9, verse 2. I have great sorrow and unceasing anguish in my heart. Unceasing anguish in my heart. There's some pain that I'm carrying around with me. Some sadness. And I need to express it to you. I need to bring you into it. I need to get it off my chest. There's something deep within my heart, and it compels me to write this letter, to do something about the pain that I'm witnessing and that I'm experiencing. So this is an extremely, extremely personal letter for Paul. This isn't a letter that it's not an academic letter that he's writing just to go through the motions. He's writing this letter because the things that he's writing about, his personal beliefs, they deeply matter to him. And they are forcing him. It's almost, you know, that moment where there's so much pain within you and you say, I can't let it continue. And you need to somehow express it, get it out. That's what Paul's doing in this letter. He's expressing his unceasing anguish. And then a third reason why Paul writes this letter. Remember, he's a pastor. So he wants to help guide these Christians to be a particular type of people in the world. He's pastoral. He's not about some abstract theology, which is what Romans often becomes for us in the modern world. He's about practical help for people. Practical steps. Application. How do we translate this Christian faith into real life action? How do we take that which is in our minds and our hearts and bring it out from us into the real world that we live in? He wants the good news of Jesus to transform these Christians. He wants that good news, the gospel of Jesus, to bring freedom, joy, peace, love, encouragement, and unity. I mean, come on. Isn't that what we all want? Couldn't we all use a bit of good news right now? Some gospel that instead of a message that enslaves us, couldn't we all use a message that sets us free, that fills us with hope, that unites us together around a common cause? I mean, we talk about this letter 2,000 years ago, and Paul talks about divisions. Are we really that much different in our world today? Are divisions not something that is front and center in the world that we live in? Couldn't we use a little more unity, a little more peace, a little more grace, a little more good news that transforms us from the inside and changes how we treat each other, that changes the worldview that we allow to shape us? So that's what Paul's doing. At the heart of this letter is a pastoral plea for these Christians to be a particular type of people in the world. That's why this letter transcends 2,000 years. Yes, it's about Roman Christians 2,000 years ago, but it's about us being transformed by this message in our lives today as well. And then a sixth question. How was this letter delivered? The Roman Christians, they didn't have mailboxes. They didn't go down to the post office and pull mail out of boxes. This was a letter that was delivered by one of Paul's associates. We're told in Romans, I believe it's 15, maybe it's 16, beginning of 16, we're told that one of his associates, Phoebe, yes, a woman, crazy in the world at this time. Paul entrusts this message to a woman. I mean, this shows you how subversive and radical the message of Jesus is. How subversive the good news of Jesus is. Paul gives this letter to Phoebe to travel whatever the distance might be from wherever Paul wrote this letter all the way to Rome so that she could deliver on Paul's authority this letter that Paul has crafted. What would have happened? She would have arrived in Rome. All these various clusters, these various communities would have heard, hey, Phoebe is here. She has a letter from Paul. We're going to meet tonight at our house. We're going to meet in our workshop, wherever all these clusters would be meeting. We're going to meet so that she can read this letter out loud to us. First Christians did not have their own individual Bible. They didn't have a smartphone where they could just Google Romans chapter 1, letter from Paul. The first time they would have heard this message would have been out loud together with their community. And the reading of this letter would have probably taken a couple of hours. It wouldn't have been a quick read through. Okay, let's get through this letter so that we can move on to better things. It wasn't, let's just read this letter and then memorize some things. Rather, the reading of this letter, when Phoebe was reading it, and she would have been trained by Paul to know when to raise her voice, when to get a little emo in the letter, even when to look at certain groups of people. Paul would have been very specific. Hey, here's how I want you to read this letter. And the reading of the letter, it wouldn't have just been her going through, reading this, everyone being silent. There probably would have been some questions asked in the midst of the letter. Hey, can you explain that a little bit more? Can you go into a bit more detail here? I don't quite get it. Are you sure Paul's really saying that? I mean, think about how different that is than our reading of the Bible today. We read through it, we memorize it, and it's something that's stuck up here. But for these first Christians, they didn't want it to stay stuck here in their minds. They wanted it to move down into their hearts so that it changed how they lived every single day. Yeah, the reading of this letter would have taken a few hours with many, many different questions. And then, after the reading was over, just imagine everyone has their work for the day. They come, they listen to this letter. This would have been late at night, especially if this thing takes a couple of hours. Imagine 2 o'clock in the morning. Many of the people might have stayed even longer in order to discuss together the implications of this letter. They would have stayed even longer to talk about, hey, this part, it really bothered me. This part, it inspired me. Think about how different this reading of the Bible was than our reading today, where for us, it's kind of like a task, or it often becomes a chore that we can just check off. Okay, I did my reading today. I memorized Romans 16:2. Great, now I can go on with the rest of life. This was something that shaped their entire existence. And then a seventh question for us this morning. What did these clusters, what did these communities look like? Now, maybe you might have guessed, but these clusters, these communities, they were called churches. Yes, they look quite a bit different than probably how you picture church today. When you think about church, you think about a building that you go to, a building with stained glass and a steeple maybe. But the first churches, they were house churches. They were churches that met in people's homes, probably churches that met in workshops, because homes, apartment buildings in the center of Rome, they would have also served as workshops for craft workers. And jammed into these apartments probably would have been about 30, maybe 40 people, but no more than that. Imagine, think about a small New York City apartment with 30, 40 people crammed into a living room or crammed into a kitchen. People who they're willing to feel a little crowded with others because the message of Jesus, the path of Jesus, is something that's changed their lives. And probably most of the people in these churches would have come from the middle, but predominantly lower end of the social hierarchy. In Peter Oakes' book, Reading Romans in Pompeii, he recreates what he believes, through archaeological evidence, what a house church in Rome would have consisted of. So he caps it at about 30 people, and he says there would have been a craft worker who rents a fairly large workshop. A craft worker would have been someone in the mid to low end of the social hierarchy. There would have been a few other householders who rent less space than the householder above, maybe some but not all of their spouses, children, slaves, and other dependents. These householders, craft workers, they probably had some slaves that were working for them. And if a householder went to someone else's home in order to form a Jesus community, a house church, he might have brought his entire household with him, including the slaves. But notice, children would have been packed in there with everyone else. There would have been a couple of members of families whose householder is not part of the house church. Maybe some spouses, some women whose husbands have said, church, I'm not going to do that thing. There would have been a couple of slaves whose owners are not part of the house church. A couple of freed or free dependents of people who are not part of the house church. There would have been a couple of homeless people. And then there would have been a few people who are renting space in shared rooms. These would have been migrant workers, immigrants, people who were, their land was devastated by the Roman Empire, and so they have traveled to Rome in order to look for work. These would have been extremely poor individuals with little to no rights. So as you can see, house church in Rome, quite diverse, made up of a very diverse group of individuals with all different backgrounds and social status. But the thing that they had in common together was their desire to entrust their lives to Jesus, to live a different story than the story that the Roman Empire was telling. Now let's dig into this question a bit more. Churches, the Greek word for churches is the word ekklesia. When Paul uses this word to describe the churches, when the early Jesus community uses the word ekklesia to describe their clusters, their communities, they're saying something quite subversive. Everyone in the Roman world knew what an ekklesia was. It was a gathered assembly. This was an extremely political word. But in the Roman Empire, there were certain people who could be a part of that assembly, that ekklesia, and certain people who couldn't be. There were people that were excluded from the ekklesia because of their social status, or because of their gender, because of their background, who they were, where they came from. This ekklesia, by using this term, basically by hijacking this term, what Paul and the rest of these first Christians are saying is, we're to be a different type of community. Sure, the Roman Empire has their ekklesias, but we have our own ekklesia, and we are living into a different story. We are learning to be a different group of people in the world. We are not being shaped by the dominant narratives that are creating pain and division. We are to be shaped by a narrative that unites, that brings peace, that is guided by grace. And we'll get into these narratives a bit more throughout the next couple of weeks. But as let's keep talking about church a bit more, because when we think about church today, we don't often think about house churches. We don't think about churches that meet in people's apartments. When I started Awaken, we began in an apartment. And eventually we came to the conclusion we're going to have to meet elsewhere than Dave's apartment, because other people aren't going to want to come into an apartment. They're going to think it's weird. They're going to think that we're all drinking red Kool-Aid together. So we began to move out from the apartment into a third space, into having quote-unquote public services. In our world today, there are many, many different forms of church. The forms, they can be good. They can be helpful. Certain forms, as many of you know, they can be harmful. They can actually take us away from the path of following Jesus. They can actually take us away from what church is supposed to be, what church is meant to be. So let's talk about the spirit behind these ekklesia, the spirit behind church. Because there's a form, and then there's the spirit that animates that form. Let's talk about the spirit that animates the form, whatever form church happens to take. First, church is a place where everyone matters. If you read through Romans 16, the last chapter in the book of Romans, what you'll notice, Paul goes to great lengths to name names. He doesn't simply say, greet all the Christians in Rome. He takes the time to name all the people that he knows. He names men and he names women. He's giving equal status to men and women, something that didn't exist in the Roman world at this time. Not only that, Paul says, verse 10, greet those who belong to the household of Aristobulus. Probably would have been some slaves. Maybe he doesn't know all the names of these slaves within this household, but he's greeting them. He's letting them know, you're a part of this community. You matter. This ekklesia, church, true back then, meant to be true for us today, is a community of equality. There's no ranking. There's no hierarchy. And this was in complete opposition to the way in which the Roman Empire operated, where there was a certain hierarchy, a social hierarchy, and you had people who are on the top, and people who are on the bottom. Paul demolishes that whole way of being and says, this community, this alternative community, it's meant to be a place where everyone feels like they matter, where everyone is equal. When we celebrate communion together, when we remember the death and the resurrection of Jesus, everyone comes to the same table. We don't have one table for those who have a little more affluence than others. We don't have one table for the slaves. It's one table. It's one shared meal for all of us. This was a revolutionary way of being in the world. So when we talk about the spirit of church, how do we determine if church is still living into that spirit today? Is that particular church, whatever form it takes, is it creating a community of equality where everyone matters and no one is seen as better or more privileged than others? I heard a story from Steph one time about a church that she had gone to. She said that this church kept in the front row, or maybe the front couple of rows, spots for VIPs. Yeah, this isn't the church that Paul is talking about. This is not the church of Jesus. This is more in line with the Roman Empire, a system of ranking and hierarchy where some are given preferential treatment. Church, it's a place where we all matter, where we're all on equal ground together. And then second, church is a place where everyone is welcome. If certain groups are excluded, if certain people are excluded, it's not a church. When I read that list, there would have been some shady characters that were a part of these house churches. Church is the place where everyone is welcome to come to, regardless of beliefs, lifestyle choices, color of skin, their past history, their current history. It's a place where we can all come to regardless of our social status. We come to church because we're on the way together. We're all at different places on our faith journey. And what we'll see as we dive into Romans a bit more, there are varying theological beliefs that these Christians held. What Paul simply does is he says, you know what, there's some things that we're going to disagree on, but let's unite together on the really, really big, important matters of faith. We're not going to always agree. There is no church, no community that is in 100% agreement, but we need all of our voices because the Spirit speaks to each of us. Remember, we are a community of equality where everyone matters, where we all have equal access to the Spirit. Church is a place of inclusion. If anyone is excluded, it's not a church. Or it's not a church that lives out the message of Jesus. It's a church that's more in line, again, with the Roman Empire, with a way of ranking and keeping others on the sidelines. And then third, the third idea about the spirit of the church. Community is how people grow in faith. In Romans Disarmed, the authors put together this fictional conversation between a Jewish Christian and a Gentile or non-Jewish Christian. And the two have lots of things that they disagree on. There's some tension. They really don't like each other. Probably was a pretty accurate picture of what was going on in these house churches. The beautiful thing about this conversation is that they were honest, they were transparent, and they were able to find common ground to agree on. They challenged each other in their beliefs, and it helped each of them grow in their faith. How are we discipled? How do we grow in our discipleship? Conversations, dialogue, being challenged by others who don't see things the same way in which we see them. Discipleship is not a program. There's not the 5 steps, the 10 steps. The path of Jesus, the way in which you grow in your pursuit of Christ, is through conversations with others. That's why for Awaken, we talk about discipleship. Community groups are the main way in which we do discipleship at Awaken. Because we believe it's through conversations with others that we grow in our faith. It's the times in which, sure, your community group has formal meeting times, but then there's the times that you get together and you're going for a hike in the woods and you're just talking with others about things that matter, about questions you have, about things that you're wrestling through. Someone asks a question, someone says something, they open your eyes in a way in which I have never seen that before. And it helps you move to the next step and the next step of your journey. So for community groups, we have formal ones at Awaken, and maybe you don't live here in Westchester. We have an online group that meets every other Sunday. Now we're going to begin meeting at 1 p.m. Would love to have you join us. Or maybe a formal community group is not your thing. Totally fine. That's okay. But find your people. Find your church. Find your ecclesia. Find your community where together you can wrestle with others through the questions that you have about faith, the questions you have about following Jesus. And then the fourth thing about the spirit of the church. The good news of Jesus is at the center of the church. Yeah, the good news, the gospel. We're learning together what it means to be people of this good news. People of generosity, of grace, of love. People of welcome, of being non-judgmental, people who show equality for all, people who live out true justice. We're learning to first receive it so that then we can pass it on. This way of being, this ecclesia, stands in direct opposition to the Roman Empire. To the Roman narrative that would have been seen everywhere these Christians went. A narrative of privilege, of power, status, ranking, exclusion, of force, of taking, of consuming, of individual personal gain at the expense of others or the expense of creation. At the center of what it means to be a church. What it means to be church in the way in which Paul and the first Christians understood it. Is that the good news of Jesus is at the center, changing us, transforming us, showing us how to live into an alternative story. So as we see here, right at the beginning, the story of the Roman Christians, it's our story as well. Yeah, it's a story that took place 2,000 years ago, but it's a story that is still being told today. They had their struggles, their challenges, their points of tension. We have our own unique challenges, struggles, points of tension, questions that we're wrestling with. They had the Roman Empire that they were trying to live differently than. We exist in a world with a different empire that is trying to shape us, inform us, in ways that take us away from the love, the joy, the generosity, and justice that God desires for all of us. My prayer as we begin diving into this book of Romans is that we would see all the ways that we have been numbed by empire, all the ways in which our imaginations have been numbed by the empire that denies justice, that excludes others, that forces itself through the world, that knocks others down for its own personal gain, that we would see through all those ways of being in the world, and that together we would be united. Together we would form communities of welcome, of equality, so that we can learn to be people of love, joy, generosity, so that we can be people who are transformed by the good news of Jesus. And then we can go and pass that good news on to others. So we can live out the good news of Jesus in our everyday lives. So may the grace and peace of Jesus be with you.